Attention, please.
This is The Drive with Josh Graham Podcast. Tune in to The Drive 3 to 6 weekdays on WSJS Sports.
I love it. It's brilliant.
Steve Forbes is going to be here in 30 minutes. And for the last few days, we've been applauding the hire for Wake Forest, and for good reason. He's already passed the 3 big tests he was set to face the moment he agreed to be the Deacons' new coach. Number 1, personality. Now, I know how that might be received by you. You might think that's a very small thing, but I don't think it is, considering the 2 previous coaches that have preceded Forbes. Danny Manning. I feel like we've learned more about Forbes in the last 4 days than I knew about Danny personally in the 6 years he was the Deacons coach. I'll tell you the moment I knew Wake had somebody different. The obvious example was the 45-second video where he's spiking a medical face mask into the practice gym floor at the Shaw Center. I don't think you'd ever catch Danny or Bezdelic dead doing anything of that sort. But his press conference opened with him telling a story about his wife agreeing to go to a recruiting trip, or I think he was interviewing for a GA job in Nebraska, and that's how they spent their honeymoon. That's something I'm interested in asking Coach Forbes about when he joins us. He just seems like a great storyteller. He's been to a lot of different places. I'm fascinated by the guy. But one of the bigger tests I think a coach has to face when you're preceding Danny Manning and before that Jeff Bezdelic, hey, do you have the energy to breathe life back into this program? It's become clear Coach Forbes possesses that. You need somebody who's going to do what John Curry did last year and start the I'm a Fan campaign, get people fired up to go to football, so you have the payoff, the first home game at BB&T Field, a pretty strong crowd on a Friday night against Utah State. Coach Forbes, he strikes me as the guy who isn't going to mind going to campus and handing out tickets to students, getting to know students, being a part of the community. So that's number 1. Number 2, re-recruiting the roster. I was listening to Coach Forbes with Les Johns yesterday on his podcast. And apparently, he took the entire staff Sawyer to Durham to meet with Olivier Saar, who entered the transfer portal last Thursday. Or it would have been last Friday, the day he was being introduced as the Deacons coach. He took the entire staff there, spent 2 hours in Durham, but this is what makes the dynamic interesting. Olivier is currently staying with Blake Buchanan's family. Walk on at Wake. The reason that is, you have to be on campus, staying in the dorms your first 3 years, you're at Wake. So Olivier had to stay on campus, that's where he lived. The other place he would be is back home in France. Now, I don't know if you know this, Sawyer, but there's this thing called the coronavirus that doesn't allow you to travel back to Europe if that's where, in fact, you're from.
Coronavirus!
I was just waiting for that. So, campus was being closed. He couldn't go back home to France, so he just bunked up and stayed with the Buchanan's family, Blake Buchanan's family, who's a walk-on onto the team. So, how does this work when it comes to re-recruiting Olivier? Is Blake being worked into this by Coach Forbes? Hey, man, you should go back to Wake. This Forbes guy seems pretty cool. Does Coach Forbes try to get the family in on it when he shows up to Durham? Does he spend time trying to get to know Blake as much as Olivier, the third team All-ACC player he's trying to recruit coming back? I just wish I could be a fly on the wall watching that all happen. So I'm not dismissing the chances Wake has of potentially landing Saar, of having him come back. But a nugget he had on the podcast with Les, he says that Odi Aguama is going to return as will Ishmael Massoud. It would only make sense for Jakobi Neath to be back as well. I don't think Neath can find another place in the Power Six where he'd be guaranteed pretty much a starting point guard position. So I don't know how he turned that down. So assuming he comes back, Massoud and Odie, that's a pretty decent team. That's a test that he passed, trying to get players who entered the transfer portal to return to Wake. If he can get Sarr, it's going to be an A+. Right now, it's just the passing grade C+, B-. If you can get Sarr to return, that's an A. And lastly, he also told Les, Randolph Childress is going to be a part of the staff. We don't know what his role's going to be yet. Jason Shea, who was the top assistant at East Tennessee State for Forbes, he's being considered for the head coaching opening. All indications say that if Shea isn't hired at East Tennessee State, he's going to arrive in Winston with Coach Forbes, which means there's not going to be any room on the staff for Randolph to be an assistant. But this is just me speculating. If Shea does get that job, I'd be surprised if Childress isn't an assistant coach. Let's not forget, there are other roles you can fulfill without being listed as an assistant coach, which he's been since 2014, the final year for Jeff Bezdelic, all throughout Danny's tenure. He was hired in 2013, initially to be the director of player development. I think what it comes down to, you just need to have some connection to Wake Forest on your roster. Because Forbes himself has no connection to this state, no connection to the school, no connection to the ACC. Randolph, he's a legacy. He's one of the all-time greats. Having him agree to be involved is a huge win as well for Coach Forbes. So I think those were the three initial tests he faced as Wake Forest coach when he came in. Personality, check. Re-recruiting the roster, check. And we'll see to what degree with Sarr. And lastly, getting Randolph to be a part of this coaching staff, I think is a huge deal. You could tweet the show at Sports Hub Triad. 336-777-1600 is the phone number. Sports is back as we shift things to KBO, South Korean baseball, and I think Sawyer, it's a lock who our team is going to be. No question about it. In the same way this show was a San Diego Fleet radio show for the AAF before that got disbanded, and we were a Houston Roughneck radio show in the XFL. I'm not wearing my XFL hat today. Before that went up in flames as well. We had our show associated with a team in each of those leagues. I feel like since the KBO is all we have right now, we need to attach ourselves to one of these teams, and the one I'm nominating is NC Dinos. That's our squad. NC Dinos. I'm going to slip up and accidentally call them North Carolina Dinos. I know it's going to happen. The obvious, they have NC in their name, Sawyer. But do you know why they are the NC Dinos?
I don't know much about the Korean Baseball League, so I don't know why.
A video game company, NC Soft, sponsors them.
It's meant to be.
That's right. Going further, if you look on the roster, they have a player named Mike Wright. Mike Wright, he's from the Carolinas. He went to East Carolina. I actually got to know Mike Wright a little bit when he was there, and he pitched for my favorite baseball team, the Baltimore Orioles, for nearly 5 years. If you're looking for icing on the cake, how about this? We all root for an underdog. Nobody wants to root for the front runners. No one likes a guy who just picks the front-running team. ESPN, they listed their power rankings for KBO teams. They're not even in the top five out of the 10 teams. But how about this? They led KBO in home runs last year. And the coolest thing about the KBO, the thing that's bringing people in, they allow bat flips. It is an art form to see the way they bat flip, even when they don't hit home runs. Someone jacked one foul, and it was a massive bat flip just in case. it remain fair down the left field line. But here's the kicker. They have a mascot who is nicknamed, and this is true, Swole Daddy. It is a jacked dinosaur, Sawyer.
Swole Daddy.
Swole Daddy of NC Dinos. It's just meant to be. Your video game tie as you're pinch hitting for Robert Walsh today. The East Carolina tie, who then pitched for the Orioles. You got NC in the name, and you have a Jack Dinosaur mascot named Swole Daddy. What else do you want? Riddle me that.
I mean, with the bat flipping, the home runs, I feel like this is like the Lob City of the Korean Baseball League. Like, we're just flashy.
Flashy underdog. Got a win this morning. 4-0. They took care of business. So we are an NC Dinos radio show. It's official. Before we get to Coach Forbes, who's going to join us in a little over 15 minutes, I've got off-season grades for the entire NFC South, with one team getting an A and another getting a D. I'll fill in those blanks for you next on The Drive. Admittedly, I'm not a big conspiracy guy, Sawyer. I don't know about you. Like, if the Kennedy assassination was assisted by the government, or if the government was concealing info about Roswell, New Mexico, I feel like somehow, some way, it would get out. Especially in the social media age. Translating that to sports, I'd argue Michael Jordan's first retirement, the conspiracy surrounding that, it is the Kennedy assassination of sports, I guess, where people are trying to figure out if there's anything to this that we don't know. We kind of hinted at it, or Jason Heyer hinted at it at the end of The Last Dance, episode 6. But I think we're going to get heavier into that in episode 7. I just don't understand the argument at this point. People saying Michael was suspended. He didn't decide to leave. He was suspended from Major League Baseball because of his gambling. For those who say that, well, he stayed out longer than a year. He stayed out nearly 2 years, except he came back after 60 or some games in the 1994 season or the 95 season. Came back. They lost to Orlando in that series. Nobody seems to count that against Michael for some reason. There's a very pro-Michael bias out there where people just seem to forget about the series that he lost in the first round or forgot the fact that in the middle of the 90s he lost to Orlando. Oh, but he started the season in baseball, so that's why he lost that year. Got it. But putting that argument aside, we could get to that at a later date. The conspiracy falls apart just on this alone. I think people who are younger don't really understand, or maybe didn't understand, the extent of Michael's fame in 1993. The extent of Michael's celebrity, how important he was to the NBA. Because just 10 years prior to that, the NBA was in deep trouble. It wasn't a failing business, but it wasn't a successful one. Star players, they had a drug problem in the league. The Bulls were the traveling cocaine circus. Heck, if we're using a local example, David Thompson's career was cut short because of drugs in the 80s. And many others can say that. Lynn Bias in 1986, just tragic stuff. David Stern, there's no way if it's under his watch, if it's on his watch, excuse me, that he would kick Jordan out of the sport. Just no way it would happen. Magic Johnson, he's already surprisingly retired because of HIV at this point. Bird retired a year before this happened. Isaiah, he's a year away from retiring. The Pistons, they aren't what they were. He's the cash cow for the entire NBA. Like, it's 3 years out of Kareem. It's the Bulls. That isn't to say there aren't other stars. Charles Barkley, just in the finals at that point. Clyde Drexler, Karl Malone, John Stockton. They're all there, Hakeem Olajuwon. But no one is remotely close to the marketing power of Michael. He transcended sports. There's no way you can convince me Stern says we need to kick that guy out. Too many people would have to have known what was up in order for that to happen. Too many people. It would have leaked. At some point, somebody tells a blogger. At some point, a columnist gets it. At some point, it happens. But it never did, because it never happened. David Stern, he's dead now. Like, if they were trying to owe something to Stern, at this point, I think it would come out with the Jordan doc being released. Nobody has spoken about this, because it's just implausible to suggest that Michael Jordan was actually suspended from the league. It doesn't make sense when he was allowed to return. How long was the suspension? Also, he didn't break any rules. There's no evidence that he actually bet on basketball. Gambling's a normal thing on the golf course. People cared still because they had this image of Michael from TV commercials. You got to be like Mike, Gatorade, Nike. They projected what they wanted Michael to be on this person who is in fact human and not perfect, who was flawed. This isn't Pete Rose, though. So Michael, he never broke any rules. He never gambled on sports. Gambling on the golf course is completely normal. And I think the doc is really setting this up well to dismiss any rumor whatsoever that Michael was suspended from basketball because of Stern's involvement and talking about it. And MJ, and what we're about to see in episode 7, the unrest from people who are bugging him about the gambling at Atlantic City and him on the golf course with a guy like Slim Bowler in Charlotte. The media coverage, the fact that nobody had beaten him in the last few years and there wasn't any up-and-coming star that you look at and you say, that's the guy I need to take down. His dad passing, which is going to be a big part, I think, of episode 7. Him always wanting Michael to be a baseball player. All of that factors in. And I think the more time goes on, and the more or the less amount of information that's out there that argues to the contrary, I believe that there's no question. Michael Jordan, he was not suspended. He decided just to go play baseball. Sawyer, do you believe any conspiracy theories? Aliens? Especially last week's news?
Well, I knew about that news 2 years ago, and I was trying to tell people.
Blink-182 is trying to tell us all.
I mean, it's definitely aliens, I think, are real. I mean, I don't know if we've ever seen them or if we know they're out there, but I think everyone knows there's UFOs. Maybe not like we don't have a little alien person like in Area 51, but they know more than they're showing.
Okay. It's time to induct another topic into our Sports Talk Radio Hall of Fame. This time it is college athletes. Should they be paid?
There are a few sports radio topics that have passed the test of time. Topics debaters have embraced for decades, and the debates still go on. This is the Sports Radio Topic Hall of Fame. Today's inductee.
Is it time to pay the college athletes?
Well, it's been time to do that for a long time. I mean, just look at the relationship that the universities have with these shoe companies, where the shoe companies are paying them $10, $20, $30, $40 million to use the players as unpaid billboards. That's what they are.
Should college athletes be paid?
Oh, yes. This is on the Mount Rushmore, as far as I'm concerned. Right there with Michael versus LeBron. Right there with Pete Rose. Should he get into the Hall of Fame? PED users, should they get in? I feel like anytime I learn or somebody learns I'm a sports talk host, the question I most commonly get when it's, hey, what do you think about this, is this question. It's the most common one. And this used to be like a 50-50 issue, even just a dozen years ago, where people thought, no, they shouldn't, and the other side believed, yes, they should. I'll tell you what flipped it in my mind. I think it was Terrell Pryor and Ohio State in the mid-2000s, the entire tattoo scandal. People lambasted these guys as if they were criminals or if they were breaking rules, breaking laws, I should say, when in reality they weren't making any money. They're these star players and they're exchanging some of their gear in exchange for tattoos. When that was seen to be a big deal by the NCAA, I think the public perceived it as, wait, why are we crushing these college kids for getting tattoos for something that should be their possession? I always hated this argument that's common with this discussion. Education is worth a lot more than the dream of being an athlete. Those people, I get that a lot. Education's everything. Yeah, it's worth something, but it's not worth the same to somebody who, let's just say that some scholarship athletes are worth more than others. That's the best way to put it. Like, at Duke, Jack White is a scholarship player, but is he worth more than Zion Williamson? Should his education, should his, what he gets in exchange for his services be exactly the same as Zion's? Probably not. Here's what I envision. I think we're going to look back on amateurism 20, 30 years from now and think, this was ridiculous. It's never going to work. It was never going to work this way. And we're going to laugh at it. Like, remember when we thought the Olympics would be ruined if star players, NBA players, competed in them? Like, amateurism is what made the Olympics? Of course that was a fallacy. We love the Olympic Games. We love watching the Dream Team, the Redeem Team. And I think years from now, we're going to look back at amateurism and athletes not being paid and think, how could that possibly work?
Providing you with a kind of sports programming that makes some people laugh. But most people just wince.
Ooh.
You're on The Drive with Josh Graham.
And now we're being joined by the man who gave him his first Power 6 opportunity, that being Billy Gillespie. But I need to correct on something I said. I was talking about the fact you're at Tarleton State. I know Stephenville pretty well, but I'm mistaken. Stephenville with Dublin, Texas, which is where Dr. Pepper is from. It's not, in fact, Stephenville, so it's the greatest mistake I've made in the history of my broadcasting career. I hope people can forgive me for that. But here, Coach, looking at Coach Forbes' resume here, I wonder, when he gets this opportunity, which is his first head coaching job, what your reaction was?
It's not his first head coaching job.
Oh, in the Power 6, excuse me.
Eddie, that's your second mistake you've ever made in history, I guess. So, hey, I'm just kidding with you. But he knocked it out of the park. His first time he got to be a head coach at the Division I level, and everywhere else he's been, you know, when he was a JUCO coach, he knocked it out of the park, and he'll go into the ACC and do the same thing. There's absolutely zero question in my mind what he's going to do at Wake Forest.
What do you remember your first impression of Coach Forbes being way back in 2004?
We've become really good friends, and I always just, when we were out recruiting at events and those kind of things in the profession, you kind of notice the guys that you really have a great respect for, whether you're working with them or really know them at all. But he was always the guy in the gym that was always paying attention to the players. He's an unbelievable evaluator. A lot of guys are watching their cell phone and checking their email and those kind of things when they're in the gym. And Steve's always been the guy that's going to evaluate better than anyone I've seen. He can really evaluate players. And once he evaluates and targets those guys, he'll go get them. And once he goes after them, he gets them. And so he's been a tremendous recruiter at every level he's been. He's always gotten better players. No matter what school he was at, he's gotten better players than they expected him to get. And that's why you win. He's a winner. He's going to continue to win at Wake Forest. I guarantee it.
He says he came from the Billy Gillespie tree of coaching defense. What exactly should we expect that to look like this fall?
Well, it'll depend on the players that they end up with. But what Steve's going to do is he's going to play solid basketball. And they've had great coaches at Wake Forest over the years. I think that out of the coaches that have been there, I was just looking down the list and what a great list it's been. But I would think they're going to be very similar to the way Coach Prosser used to play. May he rest in peace. And he did a tremendous job there. Their backgrounds are a little bit different, but a little bit similar as well. Coach had to scratch and claw and fight for everything he got. Steve has had to do the same thing. Steve's going to play a high level of basketball, and you have to in the ACC to survive and definitely to do great. And but they're going to take great shots. They're not going to turn the ball over. They're going to offensive rebound. They'll get to the foul line more than their opponents. And on the defensive end, they'll give their teams one or less shots per possession. And they won't foul, and they'll rebound the ball. And so that's winning basketball at any level. And Steve knows how to teach it as well as anyone in the country.
Philip Gillespie with us here on Sports Hub Triad. We had Coach Forbes with us about an hour ago, and people are just raving about this guy's personality and how likable he is and how easy it is for him to relate to people. Greg Marshall was with us on Friday, and he told the story about him recruiting in JUCO with a moped that Coach Forbes wanted to correct us with, saying it was, in fact, a scooter. Is there anything that sticks out to you when you look at recruiting stories, his ability to recruit, and it speaks to the personality he has and his ability to relate to guys?
When you recruited a very high level, as Steve has done and will continue to do, it's really hard to not make enemies, you know, because things just, I mean, there's so many variables, and there's going to be some people that, you know, if you offered a guy and he didn't take it, or if you offered a guy and then got someone else, or there's all kinds of things that happen over the course of recruiting, especially over the course of time. I can't ever remember one guy that didn't have a great liking of Steve Forbes. And he had been in a lot of recruiting battles, but everybody loves him. And he's got a big smile on his face. He's a jolly-looking guy. You know, we can make fun of him in a lot of different ways in that regard. And as we all, a little bit funny-looking, but he's the funniest. But he always has a smile on his face. He cares about people. And the biggest thing about Steve is he's got this real desire to win. He's a real, real, real competitor, as he wants to compete and win as much as anybody. But he has this humility that I loved having him on our staff because I knew how great he was, but he was also a guy that we could make fun of all the time, and he could laugh at himself. And a lot of people at the very, very highest level of any profession, they're too serious and they can't laugh at themselves. He's a lot of fun to have on a staff, either when he's the head coach or when he's a part of the staff. And so everybody's going to love Steve Forbes. Everybody that works in the office, everybody on campus, all the fans. He went from East Tennessee State and just turned that thing around. And he didn't just win; he just won in a big way. And what they did over there was amazing. He's going to do the same thing at Wake Forest, I guarantee you. Just as long as he has a little time to get some players.
He mentioned last Friday among the NBA players he coached, or guys who went on to the NBA, was A.C. Law, who you coached at Texas A&M. What's the best A.C. Law story you got with me?
Forbes didn't coach A.C. Law. That was Buzz Williams. He was on the other end working with the big guys. So I don't know why Forbes would lie and say that. But, no, he coached them all. We all coach every position. Pick out some particular instances and it'd be a funny story or something that would be fun to listen to. But the thing about Forbes is the consistency. He's going to be the same guy every single day. He's going to be in a great mood. He's going to change the mood of the room. He knows how to talk to players as well as anyone that I've ever been around. And I've been around some good ones. He knows when they need to be scolded. He knows when they need to have a pat on their back. And he forms these relationships that last forever. The best job he ever did with any of the players, and he did a good job with all of them, but at Texas A&M was a guy named Antonis Kavalauskas, who actually Coach Odom tried to recruit when he was at South Carolina.
Yeah.
He was a guy. Here's a great story about Forbes and his recruiting, though. I will tell you this. So that particular year, we had just taken over the Texas A&M job. And so the last day of recruiting, they had them define days that you could go out. It was September 26th. I'll never forget it. Forbes sends me up to Barton County Community College where he had recruited or where he had coached before, and he had a great friend named Soupy Campbell coaching. So he wants me to go watch this guy from Puerto Rico. And I got up there, and I said, no, I don't like him. I like that Lithuanian kid over there. And he said, no, Coach, he's no good. And I said, yeah, I like him. And he says, no, we can get him late. Don't worry about it. Well, he ends up blowing up. And we had a real fight on our hands with Bruce Pearl, who just took the Tennessee job, Coach Odom, and four or five other schools. And, And that was his great evaluation that I've already spoken of. He didn't even know what Antonis Kavalauskas looked like, who ended up playing professionally for about 15 years and winning a bronze medal for Lithuania. But we joke about that all the time, give him a hard time. Everybody misses in recruiting. But when he got to Texas A&M, he really took him under his wing, and he's the reason that Antonis developed into the player that he became.
Yeah, Coach Pearl, he's going to be with us tomorrow. And I'm interested, since after you were done at A&M, you went to Kentucky, you went up against Coach Forbes when he was on Pearl's staff at Tennessee. That seemed to be a bit of a rivalry, Kentucky and Tennessee. But since we're here in the Carolinas, is there any team in your experience working with Kentucky? Is there any team Kentucky fans hate more than Duke?
I don't know if they hate the team. I think that they have a serious dislike for Christian Laettner and for the coach. And so
that's well said.
And hey, the people that you dislike the most are the people that have had the most success against you. And so that's usually the way that goes. But I think there's a sincere dislike for those guys.
Yeah, and now Coach Forbes, he has it's part of his responsibility now to deal with that Coach K guy on a regular basis. We'll see if he's going to be up to the task.
Yeah, he will. I guarantee you. It'll be a different. It'll be a major challenge. I've had another one of our assistants go into the ACC, and he came from Marquette, Buzz Williams, and he went to a very difficult job in the ACC, and he started playing a winning brand of basketball, Virginia Tech, and they grounded out. I guess is what you would say. And he developed an unbelievable program within the ACC against the North Carolinas, the Dukes, the Louisvilles, the Syracuse, and all those guys that are supposed to be the biggest guys, and they're unbelievable every year. But if you play basketball right and you recruit the right guys, that's what Steve's going to do. They're going to move up in that league no matter how good the opponents are, I promise.
Well, I just appreciate you. I know you got a lot going on, as everybody does, amid everything that's happening from Tarleton State. It's Billy Gillespie with us here on Sports Up Tryon. Thank you so much for spending the time in the Triad and talking about your old friend Steve Forbes. It's appreciated. We're looking forward to getting to know him.
Well, y'all got a great guy over there, I guarantee it. And he's going to be fun to deal with in the media. He's a guy that won't change because he took on a bigger top job than he's ever had. He'll be the same guy. He's going to be fun. They won't be without fault, that's for sure. Nobody is. But he's going to get Wake Forest back to winning like they should.
Stay safe. Be well to you and yours, Coach. Thanks for doing that.
Thank you.
You got it. That's Billy Gillespie. Before we get to Darren Gant from ProFootballTalk.com, some important news to pass along to you right now. And this is according to WRAL, and now I see it reported by several different outlets. Governor Cooper says he's signed an executive order moving North Carolina into phase one of his three-phase reopening the state process. It's going to start Friday, May the 8th, and it's going to expire on May the 22nd. You might be wondering, what's phase one mean? Gatherings are still going to be capped at 10 people. Businesses can reopen, but it's still strongly encouraged that if you're out in public, you have to have a face mask on, or it's strongly recommended that you have that on. In addition to that, parks can open as well. So that's Governor Cooper signing an executive order a short while ago, and we're moving into phase one starting Friday at 5 o'clock. Now we're being joined by Darren Gant. Talk a little football here. A lot of things happening. Cam Newton. I asked this question yesterday, and I'm interested in your thought on it. If these were the two options, retire or take a role as a backup, what do you think would be more likely? Cam, more likely to do, retire or take a backup role? Where do you stand on that?
I don't know that it's necessarily binary. I think Cam Newton is probably willing to wait a bit. I think he's in kind of the same situation as Jadeveon Clowney is. No rush to get a deal done now. You're not missing anything. There's no OTAs. You're not missing out on anything but some Zoom meetings. So what's the rush to do anything right now? So I suspect Cam would probably just be willing to wait and become Sam Bradford and and wait and see if somebody's starter gets hurt in training camp and they get desperate. And, you know, I think there might be situations where he'd be willing to go. But I also think it's important to remember a lot of these places that allege to have starting quarterbacks don't have starting quarterbacks as good as Cam Newton. So, somebody mentioned Jacksonville to me, and I was like, well, A, why would anybody want to go to Jacksonville and play for Doug Marrone? But B, why would anybody concede the point that Gardner Minshew may somehow be a better option than you? I just don't know what world that is, to be honest with you. So, I mean, I know I'm avoiding your talk radio hot take industrial complex crafted question, but I just don't know that it's one or the other.
No, I only say it to set up something else because, Cam, I agree with you. There are a lot of teams that I think are fielding quarterbacks that aren't as good, aren't as talented as Cam is. And All I keep hearing in response is, oh, well, the market, there's just no market for him right now. And to those people I respond with, if Andrew Luck came out of retirement tomorrow, there would be a dozen teams lined up to pick him up. They wouldn't be talking about his shoulder surgery for a year. They wouldn't be talking about how many injuries he's had and him being out of the game for a year. So I just don't want to hear that. The team I throw out there, and I threw it at Joe Person as well yesterday, the Denver Broncos. Because, I mean, once upon a time, they drafted a first-round quarterback that won a playoff game, and they bailed when they had a better option available. Now, I'm not saying they're going to bail on Drew Lock, who was a second-round pick, but he's not proven, and you have a quarterback's coach who once upon a time was Cam's coordinator in Carolina in Mike Shula. Is there a place that you like potentially as a fit where Cam would be the best quarterback on the roster?
Well, I still think, I mean, the two places that have stood out to me throughout, and nothing that's happened since this offseason began has changed that. The two places that stood out to me were the Chargers and the Patriots. And I just think, every signal coming out of New England is Bill's not interested in him. Bill should be interested in him. And I think while Bill Belichick might be a prideful man who wants to do football a certain way and can't imagine a quarterback looking and dressing, you know, he had a diva quarterback last year. It's just that his name was Tom Brady and not Cam Newton. So I think New England makes all the sense in the world. Bill's never beaten Cam in their two regular season meetings. I think if there's a coach who has an agile enough mind to be able to do his football different ways. I mean, look at the way Bill Belichick's played defense. He's one play in zone. He's one play in press man. He's done it a lot of different ways. So I can't imagine he wouldn't look at Cam Newton and say, yeah, there's some stuff I can do with that. As far as the Chargers go, I mean, they went through that dance where they were talking about Tyrod Taylor and they love him and they think he's great. And then they go out and draft Justin Herbert, who I don't know if he's going to be any good or not. And either one of those places, Cam Newton walks in and he's the best quarterback on the depth chart. But that could be said about a lot of places. I mean, that could be said if we're just throwing out hypotheticals. That could be said in Cleveland. That could be said in Denver. That could be said in, you know, again, we could do this all day long. Probably about half the league would fall into that category.
Darren Gant, ProFootballTalk.com with us here. When you look at what Carolina's doing, big picture speaking, the draft and now offseason moves, I'm interested in what stands out to you because it almost seems like in free agency, Carolina, they signed before the draft 14 free agents. 11 of them were on offense, and all 11 of them were in their 20s, and 10 of the 11 did not sign more than a two-year contract with Carolina. Right. Teddy Bridgewater being the exception, he has no guaranteed money on his third year. Then you look at defense, the entire draft devoted to the defensive side of the ball. It looks like, to me, Carolina has given assurances to Matt Rhule with that big contract he was given. And this year is all about having younger guys, not tanking, talented younger players,
right,
figuring out who's going to be a big picture guy. Have you ever seen this type of strategy taking hold in the NFL where it just seems purely the priority is evaluation, seeing which guys are long-term pieces?
Well, we watched Miami do it last year. I mean, this is very similar to the Dolphins situation in my eyes. I mean, the Dolphins could have guaranteed themselves Tua the easy way by not having Ryan Fitzpatrick be their quarterback. The rest of that roster was bad enough. They would have organically reached the point of picking first overall. So, and I think there's an argument to be made that Teddy Bridgewater is going to win enough games to keep them out of the top five next year. So, and it's possible, but I think there's something to be said for being competent, for being, you know, respectable at what you do. And you don't want to create a situation, especially as a first year coach. If you're talking about building a long-term program, you don't want to create a situation where you say, okay, we know it's okay if we're going to lose, blah, 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 blah. I mean, that's just not, I don't think that's good team building. I think it's a bad way to go about thinking. You know, every time these guys go out, I mean, it's easy for fans and people who work for other teams to say you ought to be doing business this way. But every one of those 53 guys who take the field is fighting for his life. And he's trying to earn a career out here, trying to play as well as he can. So it's hard to convince guys to not be good at stuff. So I just think they're trying to be as good as they can, while being realistic about, you know, maybe not being a playoff team this year, but I think there's a value in winning six or seven games as opposed to two, because I think when you're the kind of terrible, listen, it's harder in the NFL to lose all 16 than it is to win all 16. And if you go through a season and only win a game or two or three, you're terrible in a lot of ways that's going to carry over into the future. And so I think there is value in being competent, yes.
Have you watched much of The Last Dance?
You know, I've been in and out of it, and this may sound like heresy, and I'm not trying to fire up the hot take machine, but I don't find Michael Jordan all that compelling a character for a 10-part series, because all Michael Jordan's really good at is playing basketball and selling shoes. He's never put any value whatsoever in being anything greater. And I'm not saying every athlete's got to be Muhammad Ali, but it's a little disappointing for me as a North Carolinian to see a guy who could have affected great change in this state just completely absolve himself of any responsibility. And again, not everybody has to be an advocate. Not everybody has to be an activist. And he's well within his rights to do so, but he's also squandering an incredible resource. He could have done a lot for the state of North Carolina and the nation if he had chosen to. He's just chosen not to. And while, you know, I don't take away from how great he is at basketball, I'm just not particularly interested in him otherwise because of that.
This seems to be right up your alley because you're a Charlottean, and the former mayor was outlined in this last episode, who also shares a last name with you. I don't think there's any relation there. Am I right in saying you're not related at all to Harvey Gantt?
I'm not really into genealogy, so I'm not sure. I mean, it could be. I've always respected Harvey Gantt.
Yeah.
He's a tremendous, you know, citizen of our city who's done a lot of great things at a lot of levels.
Right, so Michael Jordan, he said he gave money to Harvey Gantt because his mom wanted him to, but didn't speak publicly about it. And he, of course, gave the line, "Republicans buy sneakers too." It was Harvey Gantt versus Jesse Helms in 1990, the Senate race. What do you remember about that? Was there a lot of pressure on Michael that you remember to get involved in this somehow?
I think the culture was very different at that time. I mean, Michael was still young enough in a career at that point that there wasn't that immediate outcry. There wasn't a social media echo chamber where you would get clubbed over the top of the head for saying something or not saying something in any particular direction. So the atmosphere was different. But I know that, you know, there was certainly some pressure from some people around him, but from the pieces of the documentary that I've caught, and I've probably been, you know, like I said, I'm not purposefully avoiding it. I'm just not wrapped up in it, you know, every second and DVRing it. From the parts I've caught, I think the impression has been overwhelming that Michael is most interested in Michael, and Michael is going to do Michael business Michael's way, and anything else just really isn't that important to him. And if that means not taking a side in a political race or not, you know, inviting Isaiah Thomas onto the Dream Team, even though he's the second best point guard, you know, playing basketball at that point in time, I think it's become clear to me that Michael is the focus of Michael. And, you know, I just try, you know, I'm not trying to portray myself as a saint, but I, you know, I grew up in the Scouts and we talk about serving other people. And I think, you know, he's certainly done some things and made some donations and has the ability to, but he's just, he comes up short in my mind because he's been less willing to, you know, advocate for anything other than Nike or McDonald's or Mike.
Before I let you go, we usually talk about shows and music and entertainment when you're on with us as well. Obviously, there aren't things to attend right now. And I see a lot of people who say they're going to be incredibly hesitant to go to a show or go to a game whenever that time comes. How do you view
it? It's going to be hard. I mean, there are shows. I was talking to the girlfriend the other day about a show that was scheduled to come to Charlotte on September 1st. And I said, you think we can go to that? And she said, do you think we'll want to? And I don't know. I mean, I'm hesitant about it. I think it'll be easier to go to a show out at the outdoor amphitheater, sit on the lawn, you know, spread out a blanket to allow yourself a little space with your neighbor. But, you know, the feeling, some of the best shows I've ever seen are in small clubs where, you know, the intimacy is part of the sell. I mean, when you can feel that energy from the band and from the people watching the show, I think it's going to be difficult. I'm like a lot of people in Charlotte and the outlying area. I've got a lot of money tied up in Rolling Stones tickets right now. Because they postponed and not canceled, they're not giving back to us yet. So I really want to see Keith Richards play one more time in my life. I really want to see Mick sing and dance and perform one more time in my life. I'm not as excited about getting in a crowd of 50,000 people. I'm just not. And I don't know when it's going to come back. I hope it does because it's something that I enjoy a lot and want to be a part of, because I truly believe that communal experience, when you're in a space with an artist and they're feeding off your energy, you're feeding off theirs, that's one of the most sublime things you can be a part of. I don't know if I told you the story, but when I went to see Peter Frampton, I think it was last summer, Frampton's got a degenerative nerve issue that's going to keep him from playing guitar at a certain point in his life. And he plays for us, and he said, hey, I just want to let you know, I think this is sacred. I'm sharing this with you. And there is a bond between artist and audience that's real and tangible, and I miss it. But at the same time, I don't know when I'm going to feel like getting in that crowd again.
It kind of reminds me of Bob Dylan, who still performs. He goes out there, and I forget who it was. It might have been you who told me this. We were discussing it, but the people who said, ah, man, like, I don't know if I'm going to go see Bob Dylan. I still regret not going to go see him in Colorado, but someone came back at me and said, do you honestly think Bob Dylan is going out there for you? He's doing that for him. And many other musicians, I think, feel the same way, and I don't know how it changes if there aren't as many people or if we're not allowed to gather the way that we normally did.
Right. I mean, listen, I'm not an artist like Bob Dylan, but I write for a living, and I like people to read the stuff I write, and singers like people hearing their songs and sharing in them and dancing along or whatever it is they do. I mean, art has to be collaborative at a certain point for it to have value.
It's good to hear your voice, Darren. Thanks for doing this, buddy.
Yeah, man, anytime.
Got it.
Talk to y'all soon.
That's Darren Gant from ProFootballTalk.com. There is something he said there that I thought was interesting. Michael Jordan, he cares about Michael Jordan, and he cares about selling shoes. And damn, is he good at selling shoes. Because watching The Last Dance, I don't know if anybody else feels this way, I really want to get a pair of Jordans. It almost sounds like heresy. But I've never had a pair of Jordans in my life. Never. I don't know if that's strange, but Sawyer, you're a pretty big sneakerhead. If I got a pair of Jordans, which one should I get? Should I go the originals?
I've been thinking of this. I don't think you're a high tops guy. I think we automatically almost have to rule out really high tops because I just don't see you rocking them. I think when I think of all the Jordans, like a Jordan 3, like a really classic, like not super low, like ankle cut, but just like a nice Jordan 3, you could rock those in some jeans and a t-shirt like you would. Like they're not too, you know, like in your face, like it's your shoe. I think you could rock one of those.
I'm looking for it. Jordan 3s?
A Jordan 3, yeah. Maybe you could go black. I don't really know what, I've never really seen you in white shoes before, so it's hard to picture you in the white Jordan 3s. You could probably go the black Jordan 3s and be just fine.
Yeah, I don't really wear black shoes.
You only wear black shoes.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I've seen you in the same pair
these
of
are
black
more,
shoes.
These are more gray than they are black.
Oh, well. Yeah, that's kind of true.
White shoes, they can get nicked up easier. So, okay, so I should get a pair of Jordan 3s. What do those generally run?
Ooh, man.
$200? $250?
You can probably get them under 200. You just got to look in the right
I'm
going
to go buy a pair then.
I think you have to.
How about you do this for me, Sawyer? You pull up 4 different types of Air Jordan shoes. And I'll even take suggestions from the audience on Twitter at SportsUpTriad. At SportsUpTriad, what type of Jordan should I get? And I'm going to go buy a pair. I'm going to buy a pair of Jordans. There. I committed to it. I'm going to make it happen. I don't know how much it's going to cost me. I don't really care.
Whoa, we got a big baller here. Okay.
Oh, no, I'm not going big baller brand shoes. I'm going Jordan brand shoes. Let's get that straight.
I think the Air Jordan 3s are the one for you. I think because they're kind of similar to the ones.
What about the Zions?
Which ones?
Does he have his own shoes yet?
Not yet. Maybe soon.
How does Zion not have his own pair of shoes yet? How's that a thing? What's taking so long for Jordan Brand to put out a Zion shoe?
Well, we are in the midst of a pandemic and no basketball. That might be...
Yeah, he just started playing in January.
Yeah, it's only been a couple months.
So should I just hold out for a Zion 1 or get a pair of Jordans?
No, you got to get a pair of Jordans.
All right, I think I'm going to do this.
And you got to go like low number.
Maybe I'll get... So you send me what you think I should get, and we'll run it past B-Dot, who's going to be with us on tomorrow's show. We also have Bruce Pearl on tomorrow's show. And we got the head coach of the Charlotte Hornets, James Borrego. So maybe he could tell us what his favorite pair of Jordans are, too. So that way, I can get a bunch of perspective here. Robert's also going to be on B-Dot's Instagram Live speed dotting show.
Is that tonight?
Oh, that's Wednesday. That's tomorrow.
I'm waiting for that so long.
I think Robert's trying to get out of that.
Oh, yeah. He's a little sick today.
Oh,
maybe,
I'm not feeling so good.
Yeah, maybe tomorrow night he's not feeling
I don't want to make
good.
Fun of Robert for not feeling good because how awful would we feel? Well, I'm just not going to go there.
Yeah, let's not even talk.